want to run. So I'm not grading these as how many you got right or wrong anyway. They're exercises. But I do want you to turn them in. So just sit in class and get some information, stand in there, and do the exercises. It's a matter of going through the work of it, and so I think it'll still be all right. You know, I'll have to go with some, but it'll be better.
Okay.
I'm not looking for finesse here. It's a pretty laborious process. I would do them in pencil anyway, in case you made mistakes, you know, right? We have some volunteers to pass out papers for... These are just basically a check. I wasn't grading on how many you got right or wrong. It was an exercise. I was mainly looking at whether you did them all and have the appropriate corrections and so forth, so you're getting the learning experience. The test will determine how much you know about it anyway. On some of the future ones I will, because there'll be certain rules of inference and things I don't expect you to memorize.
Yeah.
But as far as the basic... What you might do is, when I give a quiz on this material, I expect you just to be able to know the material, but it all involves knowing the truth tables for the basic functions. Those things you should probably memorize. What you could do if you take a test is memorize those things and then just write them down. From memory when you start, as a scrap paper. Yeah, that would probably be the best way to go. Well, what I would do is even go back and do those and put them in. Yeah, go ahead and do them because they're exercises. They're not like a test or something. So we have discussed the answers, but I'm not so interested in actually bringing the bullet to the work. That's the more important thing. So do them and turn them in, and I'll give you some consideration. They're definitely better than nothing.
Okay. First of all, let's take a look at the assignment for today. And there are several purposes in giving this assignment. One was to enable you to see that you can work out some rather complex problems with the truth table method. But the second was for you to see that there must be a better way. And you get to do a couple of those 16-line ones. Can you imagine what a 32 or 64-line one would be? It can be done, but by the time you go through all those ones and zeros, you know, you hardly know what you've really done. And that's what we're leading into. We're leading into an easier way to do this so that you won't have those huge columns of truth tables. So rejoice. There'll be a lot quicker way to do some of these problems. But let's go through these. And first of all, we'll start with the simpler ones. I don't know if I'll do every one of these, but I think what I'll do first is go through and just give you the answer valid or invalid on each one of them. And so that way you can see where you made your mistakes so that you can ask me how to do that particular one. And if everybody got a certain one right, there's probably no reason to go through it on the board. But if you've got a question about it, why you got it wrong, then I want you to go through one by one. If there's questions on them, I'll put them on the board. Okay, the first one should be valid. Number one, valid. Number two, invalid. Line three, if you did it in the right order, line three is the one that's bad. Of course, it's not necessarily right order. You might have done it in a different order, got a different line, so I won't say that so much, but it's invalid. Number three should be valid. Number four is valid. Number five is valid. Number six is invalid. Number seven is invalid. Number eight is invalid. Number nine is valid. And number 10 is valid. I'll just repeat the answers and then we'll go through them. Number one, invalid. Number two, invalid. Number three, valid. Number four, valid. Number five, valid. Number six, invalid. Number seven, invalid. Number eight, invalid. Numbers 9 and 10 are both valid. Okay, now I might have made a mistake too, so that's why if we go through, you can see it's easy to slip on some of these things. You get this many numbers, so I'm pretty sure that these are all right. But if the Lord wants to humble me, he can. Okay. All right, any questions on number 1? Don't be ashamed if you got it wrong and you didn't know why. Something, go ahead and ask them. I'll put them on the board if there's any questions. Number 1. Okay.
I do.
Okay, Dave.
I was gone last weekend. Uh-huh. I don't understand it for sure.
Okay.
So
I'll put number 1 on. That'd be a good prototype for the rest. What we're trying to do is prove an argument valid or invalid. And the way you do that with a truth table is construct a truth table for the various statements. Having constructed the truth table for the statements, label which ones are premises or premises and which ones are conclusions. And having done that, look under the truth table columns and find out if there's any place where the premises or premise is true, but the conclusion is false. If you can find any such place, the argument is invalid. If you can find no such place, the argument is valid. Okay? So the first one, P.Q, therefore P is our argument. So P.Q is the premise and P is the conclusion. Okay? I've got two variables in my argument, P and Q. So I'll list those two variables. And appropriate truth table designations for those. Okay. Then I've got P dot, and P I've already got here, that's my premise. I mean, conclusion, excuse me. And P dot Q is the premise. P dot Q, I just go through and apply this operator as I normally have. The conjunction is true of both elements. Okay, this is my premise. This is my conclusion. Now I go through and compare these two columns and see if I can find any place where the premise is true but the conclusion is false. And that would make the argument invalid. Well, my premise is only true in one place. And lo and behold, the conclusion is true too. And there's no other place where the premise is true, so I don't have to worry about the rest of this. I can find no place where the premise is true, the conclusion is false. Therefore, the argument is valid. Any other questions on that?
I had it the other way around.
Okay.
If there's any place where they're both true, then it's valid.
Oh, no, it doesn't work that way. No, you can't find, because there's going to be a lot of arguments where there will be instances where both, where everything's true. But there, all it takes is one place where the premises are true and the conclusion is false to make it invalid. And then that makes the argument no longer, in other words, the argument does not guarantee the truth of the conclusion anymore, because sometimes it might work, but there are times when it might not, so you've got no assurance anymore. You see, and the argument becomes an invalid argument.
Isn't an argument invalid if it has one premise?
No, it would be, well, that wouldn't be a critical factor. That might occur in some cases, you see. Because in a valid argument, having a false premise will give you sometimes a false conclusion or maybe even a true conclusion, depending on the circumstances. But that does not necessarily guarantee that the argument is valid or invalid. That just has to do with the truth values you happen to have in that instance. You see, an argument is going to be valid if every time the premises are true, the conclusion is also true. That's what determines a valid argument. If a premise is false, then you lose your testing ability anyway, because a false premise is going to generally result in a false conclusion. So you're not surprised by that. Even if the argument's good, a false premise, if somebody's lying to you as far as one of their premises, then their conclusion is no good, even if their logic is sound. So all we're concerned about is the soundness of the argument, the validity of the argument. And the validity of the argument is determined by having true premises guaranteeing a true conclusion. So what we're going to do is construct all the possible instances of truth values for premises and conclusions. And looking at those, see if there's any instance in this particular argument where we've got a true premise, or both premises true, or all, however many premises there are, true, but the conclusion false. If we can do that, we could show a place where the truth of the premises did not guarantee the truth of the conclusion. And you could have true premises and come up with a wrong conclusion, which means there's something wrong with the logic. The argument's not valid. Okay? But it doesn't necessarily work if you can just find a place where they're all true. That's not enough. They've got to be, in every case in that whole truth table where the premises are all true, the conclusion has to be true in order to be valid. If you can find one place where the premises are true and the conclusion is false, then it's invalid. Yeah.
So an argument for that didn't have an instance where there were two premises but a false conclusion, but it did have an instance of one false and one true, and then a false conclusion, that would still be a valid conclusion.
Yeah, it would still be valid. Because,
you see, here, if my premise is false all the way, I'm not putting any force on what the conclusion will be. If the premise is a lie, the argument still might be a good argument. So I have not discredited the validity of the argument by sticking a false premise in. It's only invalidated when the premise is true, but the conclusion is false. That's what invalidates an argument. If you've got a false premise, it's not going to tell you anything. I mean, you've got a bigger problem than the validity of the argument now. You're starting out with a lie, so you can't really expect to conclude anything, even if you have good logic. You see, this is what happens to people all the time, and this is what the devil does sometimes. He'll bring you a logical argument, but with a false premise, and you still end up with a lie. Starts with a lie, garbage in, garbage out. and but the logic may be good. You may have a good computer, but you put something junk in and it'll come out junk. That's what we're distinguished. What we're wanting to say to determine, see, in order to test a valid argument, we have to test it in the case where the premises we know are true, and then see if the conclusion is always guaranteed. That's the place where we're going to test the argument to find out whether it's valid or not. We can only test it in cases where the premises are true. And if the premises are true and the conclusion is always true, whenever the premises are true, then you got a valid argument. Okay? Any questions on number two? Turns out to be invalid.
Here, maybe I
should say
something.
This one was... Part of it is your labeling here. There's
that's
only,
what I thought. Yeah. I got confused.
The premise of the argument number two is P horseshoe Q. That's the premise. These aren't. Those are just the intermediate steps to reach your conclusion.
So if you only have one premise, like that's true and a false conclusion, you only need one premise to be true.
Yes, that's right. See, this you have to look at your argument and evaluate how many premises are in that argument. These first few, I only give you one premise. The argument has only one premise and one conclusion. And so you have to be careful when you're labeling things.
So it's invalid because of that.
Because of the fact that my premise was true in this instance, but my conclusion was false.
So
you only find one place. In line three, maybe anyone else want me to put this on the board? Okay.
I understand it now, but I don't know why I put down.
I think you marked.
Premise.
Yeah, that's where you made your mistake. Your truth table looks right there.
Yes.
But you see, those statements, not P and not Q, are just intermediate steps. You shouldn't have anything labeled on those.
Okay, so we don't have to break those, even though we break them down in the table, we don't have to break down.
Oh, let me just illustrate here with this particular one, P, Q. Okay. The argument started out P horseshoe Q, therefore not P horseshoe not Q. Okay. This is the premise here, and this is the conclusion, this whole statement. Now, P, I would not label P or Q as premises or conclusions. They're not. They're just parts of the premise and parts of the conclusion. And so my truth table, I'm trying to arrive at all the possibilities. And P horseshoe Q, I'll just write that down. Now, that turns out to be my premise, and I'll label that premise. So P horseshoe Q, I've got 1011. And now I'm going to write not P down here as an intermediate step to building this statement of the conclusion, the truth table of that. So I'll put not P in the column, and I'll put not Q in the column. But see, your mistake was you labeled both premises too, and they're not. They're just intermediate steps as to building this total conclusion. So we'll just put those in, you see. And now from these two, we'll make not P horseshoe, not Q, just applying the material implication rule to these. And so I've got true, true, 0, 1. And now, this is the conclusion.
Now, if I want to determine validity, what I'm going to do then is look at my premise or premises and find out. Now, if I had more than one premise, I'd have to make sure they were all true and see. But I only had one premise in this case. If I had an argument that had five premises, I'd have to look through all five premises and find a place where they all lined up at once, and then look at my conclusion column, and if it was one every time that happened, it would be valid. If I found a place where it was zero over there, when everything else was one, all my premises were one, then it would be invalid. So, my premises, I just look at the places where my premise is true, and see if the conclusion is always true. Well, here it does. My premise is true, my conclusion is true. Here my premise is false, so I don't need to worry about this. But here, my premise is true, my conclusion is false. So, if I just circle this, here, this is the line that makes the thing invalid. I've got a true premise and a false conclusion. Okay? Now, number three is valid. Any questions on that, anybody? Notice the relationship between number two and number three. It's just a reversal. They both started out with the same premise. P horseshoe Q, therefore not P horseshoe not Q is invalid, but P horseshoe Q, therefore not Q horseshoe not P is valid. That argument, the number three, will turn out to be one of our rules of inference a little bit later on. It's a handy thing you can negate. When you negate an implication, you reverse the terms. And you can reverse them and negate it. And negate them both. You see, reverse them. You got Q horseshoe, not P. But you can't do it. You can't just put a negation sign on both terms. It'll make a different statement. Yes? Yeah.
On number three, I have a place where I mark it valid because of the way I think of it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a line on line three where my premise is true, mm-hmm, and my conclusion is false.
Okay, that if you had that, then you would conclude that with an invalid argument.
But it is valid, right?
It is valid, yeah. You might have just slipped a cog there someplace. Mm-hmm. Anyone else come up with invalid on that one? Okay, let me just, we can do it with what we got on the board here, actually. All we have to do is just write a new conclusion, not Q, horseshoe, not P. The mistake that's likely to be made here is that you've got to go in reverse here.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's easier for you, you might just write not P over on this side.
Oh, yeah, I see.
And that'll help you.
I get it right now.
Yeah, you've got to take this term first. And so in this case, we're going to have a 1. In this case, we're going to have a 0. In this case, we're going to have a 1.
Yeah.
Okay. Now this is our new conclusion. Mm. It does work out to be valid. In fact, it's even more than valid, as you'll see. These two statements are logically equivalent because they've got the exact same truth table. See, notice 1011. In fact, they're identical logically, and we're going to use that a little bit later on because with this information, anytime you see this, you can pull it out of your argument and stick this in instead. And maybe do some more manipulations with that. It makes it very convenient. These are the kinds of things we're going to be using to simplify our arguments. You may not see how you can do that yet, but we'll work on it. All right. Anyone else? Any question on this one? Number four was valid.
I didn't have a problem with it, but I think I'm still confused about this. I broke that down.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
You still have only one premise. These are just intermediate steps to reach your premise. This is your premise here. These are not.
Yes, the entire thing is
just a total statement. But you see, some of these premises are big, so they take several steps to arrive at in your truth table column, each applying a different operator. But the partial things are not the premise. Okay. The premise is the total thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's probably what happened there. That's why we need to go through these, make sure everybody's got things straight. You know? There's no way to really learn a subject like this without doing exercises and things. It's like Greek or Hebrew or something. You got to do it and find out what mistakes you made and work it out. Does anybody else have a problem with number four? Invalid. There's no place in that argument where the premises are true and the conclusion false. In fact, if you got this right, if you look at your columns, if you look at your premise column and look at your conclusion column, what do you notice? They're identical. Now, this is another rule of inference. These are logically equivalent statements. And because we're going to be talking about how to define those real soon today, but they're identical. They've got the same truth table. so they're going to function the same in any logical argument, and you could substitute those two expressions for each other. That turns out to be another very useful rule of inference. Okay, number five. P, Q, and P dot Q. Okay, in this case, P and Q are both premises, and P dot Q is the conclusion. And that turns out to be valid. Because, actually, you're just writing down the definition of the conjunction in the truth table and using the two elements as P and Q as your premises and your conclusion, P dot Q. And that is always true when the premises are true, you see. There's only one place where the premises are both true, that's the first line. And in that line, the conclusion is true. So the argument's valid. In other words, whenever P is true and Q is true, then P and Q is true. Nothing really mysterious about it. You got two true statements and they're both true, you know, and the conjunction of them is true. Okay? Anybody with a question on that? So in that one, you should have labeled P as premise, Q as premise, and conclusion P dot Q. Number six turns out to be invalid. Anybody want me to put that one on the board? That one, right? Okay, now that's got three variables. So how many lines do you have in your truth table?
Eight
lines, yeah. 2 to the 3rd. 2 times 2 times 2 is 8. And it's invalid because of the the way I set it up would turn out to be the last line. It would depend on which order you put your premises and so forth. So it might not have been in yours, but on mine it was the last line that made it invalid. I had the premises both true and the conclusion false. All right. Number seven. This turns out to be invalid. And does anybody have a question on that?
Yeah. I have a question on that before that. I just noticed that I have two places where I made it invalid.
Okay. I only had one. Let's. This is number six, you mean?
Number
seven, I've got two places.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number seven, there's two places.
Oh, okay. The way you said that, I thought you only had.
No, I should have been more clear. But there's two spots in mine. It turned out to be lines 5 and 7.
Okay.
Now's your chance. I don't have any problem putting it on the board. I want to do it if there's anybody needs clarification. Yeah. Okay.
I don't see how you got that.
Okay. Let's do it then. Because this is what I want to do. I don't want you to be left in the dark, especially when you get this many variables. Okay, our argument, and notice, which one do you want me to put on, 7 or 6?
7.
Okay. P horseshoe Q, Q horseshoe R, therefore R horseshoe P. Okay, the first thing we need to notice about the argument is that we've got three variables, P, Q, and R, which tells me how to set up my truth table in the first place. It tells me I'm going to need 8 rows. Got three variables, P, Q, and R. Generally, we'll put those in alphabetical order. And in this case, I've got three variables, so I know I'm going to need 8 rows, and I'm going to be double alternating all the way. So I'm going to have, just write down 4 ones, half of ones, and half of them zeros. And I better do this. These big ones, it's really important to keep the lines straight. Okay. Now with Q, I go 1 1 0 0 1 1 0 0. This is purely mechanics. And 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0. Anybody have any question on how to do that? That's just pure mechanics. Yeah.
I don't have a question on that, but I have a question on the variables.
Mm-hmm.
With the order of them.
Okay.
We had R first, then Q, then P. Would it make a difference?
No, it wouldn't make any difference.
It's always the same no matter what order you have them in?
Yeah, it's always going to work out the same. We just establish certain conventions as well. You see, you could label these things any way you wanted and still get different combinations. All it would do is make the spots and the rows a little bit different the way they came out. You still end up with the same combination. I could have put R, P, and Q here and had this arrangement of numbers. Wouldn't have made any difference really logically.
Okay, when you do your little statement,
mm-hmm.
do you always then go in alphabetical order?
In other words, looking at this and then finding out what variables I've got and then putting them down, do you mean?
I'd say your first statement, would you ever have Q, first you P or, you know what I mean?
Oh,
no,
well, I see.
Going alphabetical order.
Oh, no, no. That's going to depend on, you see, each one of these symbols represents a statement. It represents something in a logical form. And I can pick any statements that I want to start with. And usually in the first statement, generally when you're just making up an argument, you'll probably have an alphabetical order because that's the one you just happen to pick to symbol. But once you've established the symbolic sequence, then you've got to preserve that symbol regardless of what order it comes in. So my next one is Q, horseshoe, R. Well, that happens to be alphabetical order, but R, horseshoe, P is certainly not. And I have to preserve its location. Once I've established what that symbol represents, then it remains fixed regardless of any kind of order throughout the rest of the argument. It's just a matter of arbitrarily picking it. You could have picked it Q, or you could have picked, you know, a lot of different letters to represent these, but just by convention, what, you know, when we use these symbolic forms, what type of order we started with. Usually we start the first variable in the sentence. So, you know, the first time a variable is introduced in the argument is probably going to have the lowest available order of the letter in the alphabet. But the second time that same variable is introduced, you see that it's going to have to, regardless of what order it follows, it's going to have to be the same one. Okay. But you could have arranged these, you could have labeled these in any order. It's just easiest to do it in alphabetical order and then do this in this particular order. You could actually have done these columns in different orders too, you know. You could have put Q as 1111111 and 000, and P as all double alternating and things. It's just easier to do it this way so you don't get mixed up and don't have to forget one or something along the way. And that's all this is. All this is mathematically what you're doing. Is taking all the different possibilities of three things that have two possible values and just all the permutations of those. That's all that's involved. You notice the top row is all ones, the bottom row is all zeros. And you got two ones and a zero, 101, 100, say 011. See, it's just the sequence of all the different variable possibilities and positions that can occur. All right? Actually, it's combinations rather than permutations. So you don't have to worry about that. Now, let's go through this. The most likely difficulty that's going to happen, again, is in doing these horseshoes, making sure you get the right variable first as far as applying the operator is concerned. Now, P horseshoe Q, then, we just go down the line here. P horseshoe Q is going to be true. In the case of P is true and Q is true, so that's a 1. That's a 1. That's a 0, remember. That's a 0. In other words, the implication is false when the antecedent is true and the consequence false. That occurs in both of these places. Now remember, when the antecedent is false, this is always going to be true. Okay? Anybody with a question on that? That's just applying the truth table that we had for the horseshoe symbol. That's all it is. And that's mechanical, too. You just got to make sure you get the right spots mixed with the right spots. Q horseshoe R, that's going to be taking these two columns, Q horseshoe R. So Q is now my antecedent, R is my consequence. And it's going to be true here, it's going to be false here, it's going to be true here, true here, true here, false here, true. No, or R horseshoe P. This is the tougher one because we start over here. So R horseshoe P. If this is true and this is true, then it's true. If this is false, it's going to be true regardless. See. If this is true and this is true, it's true. Here, it's okay. Here, it's a problem because I have the antecedent true and the consequent false, which makes the thing false. There it's true, there it's false. Okay, now what I do is this is a premise. That's my first premise. Q horseshoe R is a premise. And this is a conclusion. Now I go through the columns, and what I'm trying to find is a situation in which I have the premise is true but the conclusion false. So here's the first place where I have both premises true, and behold, the conclusion is true. So it's valid so far. Okay, now in this case, one is true and one is false, so don't worry about that. Here's the next place where I have both premises true. But in this case, the conclusion is false. So this line is invalidating. Same happens here in this line. Even though I've got two lines where the premises are true and the conclusion is true, I've also got two lines, two possible areas, in which the premises might be true and the conclusion is false. That makes the argument invalid. right, anyone else? Question on that? Okay, number 8 turns out to be invalid. And the way I set it up, I had lines 4 and 6 in discrediting it. Anybody have a question on that one? Gives you good exercise in getting your horseshoes in the right. Nothing else. Invalid. There's two places that make it invalid. Okay, go to number 9, 16 line. 4 variables. Turns out to be valid. Anybody have a question on it?
This is the one that I was talking about earlier where there was one premise true and one false if the conclusion is false.
Mm-hmm. No. If it's only in the place where both premises are true that you're even going to look at your conclusion line. And what you have to have is both premises true and the conclusion false to invalidate it. One of your premises false, you know.
We have that situation here too. So here's a false premise and a true premise. The conclusion is true in this case. But we have to find a place where the premises are both true in order to test it. If the premises are both true, a valid argument will always have a true conclusion. But this one has two places where the conclusion is false. That makes it invalid. So I don't really care about all these spots where one is true and one is false. I'm not even worried about those. I'm just looking for the places where all my premises are true and finding out from those whether my argument is valid or not by looking at whether the conclusion turns out to be true in those cases. Okay, now number 9 is going to have 16 variables. You start out with P, Q, R, and S. In the P column, you should have 8 ones and 8 zeros. In the Q column, 4 ones, 4 zeros, 4 ones, 4 zeros. In the R column, 2 ones, 2 zeros alternating, and then in the S column, 1 0, 1 0, 1 0 on down the line. Okay? And if you follow that through, then you'll discover that your premises, there won't be any place where your premises are true, but your conclusion is false. Let me just double check it here just to make sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the case of P and Q on number 10 here, P and mm-hmm. Q and R and S, if P and Q is false and R and S is false, does that make P and Q and R and S false or true?
Okay, say that again. Are you looking at the truth table, you mean?
Yeah, look at the truth table.
Okay.
And P and Q and R and S.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, okay, that particular conjunction.
Right,
okay.
That conjunction is
Are you looking at number 10 or
yeah,
number... Okay, you're looking at number 10. I was looking at number 9. Okay, I'm sorry.
I guess my question is,
mm-hmm.
if P and Q is false, when you conjunct that
mm-hmm.
with R and S, which is false,
mm-hmm.
does that make P, Q, and R and S false or true?
Okay, each one of them individually, the conjunction between P and Q by itself can be false if either P or Q is false.
Uh-huh.
And if, in other words, that whole statement will be rendered false if any one of those things is false. If P is false, or Q is false, or R is false, or S is false, any one of those things being false will render that whole expression false. In fact, if you look at your truth table column under P.Q.R.S., notice that you should have only a 1 in the top row and zeros all the way through. Why? Because the conjunction is such that everything's got to be true in order to make the conjunction true. Now, if you're compounding the conjunction and adding more things in, every one of those things is going to have to be true too, because if one of them is rendered false, say here's my P.Q and my R.S. If my S is false, then R.S is false. So that's a false statement now conjoined to another statement, and even if all those are true, the whole thing is going to be false. Say one of those things is enough to render the whole thing false. And this maybe is a hint to you. When you see a whole string of conjunctions, I mean, you could theoretically string out 20 of them or 100 of them or a million of them, and just one of them being false is enough to render the whole statement of the conjunction of all those things false.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as though, you know, if you offend in one point of the law, you've broken the whole law, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. See, you can get some information by these truth table columns. You can begin to learn some things about the way these things function, and you can see from that column, well, that thing's only true if P, Q, R, and S all have to be true in order to make that statement true. and any one of those things being false is enough to render that whole statement false. Okay? That was one of your intermediate steps, your premise or conclusion. But okay, anyone else? Question on number 10.
You could also get the conjunction between P dot Q and R dot S by looking over here on your P, Q, R, and S, the very first column.
Mm-hmm.
You see that only the top row matches
up. Yeah, if you were doing it that way, see, with conjunctions, we usually like to do them in a certain order, but if everything's a conjunction, I suppose we could even do away with the parentheses, you know. In fact, you'll see later on that some of our rules are such that we can adjust parentheses when we have a situation like that. And that there's ways that we can, if we've got an expression, P dot Q, parentheses, dot R dot S, we can juggle all those terms around and the parentheses around within that and still have the same logical expression. Sometimes it's valuable to do that in order, because if there's another expression that doesn't appear obvious here, but you can pull it out of that, then you may be able to work with it. You'll see what it means later on. Okay, does anybody have a question on number 10? All right, why don't you then just turn your assignments in, pass them to the front, and I'll take a look at them. And now you know why men have invented rules of inference to reduce the workload here. I didn't want to give you any five-column ones. I figured just a couple 16 rows would well convince you of the validity or the worthwhileness of going on to find simpler ways of doing things. Okay, why don't you pass them down. Okay, next time we're going to have a little quiz, because I don't want to get you too far into this without having some feedback and some... I've got to give you some grades, too, so... We'll have a quiz next time covering the material up to statement forms. Remember last time I started talking about statement forms. It will not cover that material, but it'll cover right up through the fallacy of nine antecedents, and modus tollens. It was the last thing I gave you there. Modus tollens is the valid argument, and the fallacy denying the antecedent is the invalid argument. But the test will cover up through that. Now, basically, the test is, I don't think you need to worry so much about the introductory material and all of that, but just review it, review your definitions of terms, you should know what induction, deduction is, what an argument is, that kind of thing. But it'll be especially stressing the symbolic logic. So, what you need to do for sure is know your truth tables for your basic symbols, basic operators. If you know those well, you pretty well have it made. But know your operators and know the truth tables for those operators, and the test will consist of things like this: getting problems, translating some written forms into symbolic logic, and what I'll probably do is give you an argument in written form, have you translate it first into symbolic form, and then using the truth table method, decide whether it's valid or invalid, that kind of thing.
What do you mean by know the truth table for basic operators? You mean know how to set up the truth table for the different...
Well, yes. Know how to make one of these, for example. You need to know how to put your variables in and alternate and this kind of thing. I'll be honest with you. I won't give you anything greater than a three-variable one, because it would take you too long. You know, and I'm not interested in just seeing how much arithmetic you can do. I'm interested in seeing if you understand how these things connect together and so forth. So, maximum of three variable argument with eight row truth table. And you need to know that, but you also need to know the operators. In other words, I'm not going to give you, your notes will not be available to know that P horseshoe Q is defined by this particular. In other words, you should be able to know this. Okay. Know that the truth table looks like this.
So if we saw the truth table without the operator, we could identify the operator.
Well, I'm not even so much interested in that as that you know what to do when you're starting your work. You've got to know this information in order to know how to come up with these different expressions in your truth table. You see. And it's not really that difficult. You know, I'm not even so concerned that you can picture this truth table in your mind as that when you see this symbol, you know how to operate on P and Q to get the proper result. You know that P horseshoe Q is true when P is true and Q is true, but it's not true when P is true and Q is false, that kind of thing. In other words, these basic definitions. What you might want to do is just memorize these, and as I told one sister, just when you take the test, first thing you do is write down all your operators so you don't forget them.
and then just use those as a scratch sheet to do all the rest. That's perfectly all right. But you should know your negation, your disjunction, your dot, and your horseshoe. Those are the basic. You should know those and the functions of them. And that's pretty what it boils down to. That's the only ones we've had. We will get to a symbol like this today, but I'm not going to hold you responsible for that. And you should know your punctuation, know how to punctuate things and the order in which to do them. So just review the exercises that you've already taken, and the quiz will be along those lines. It won't be asking you for anything new. You should know basic terminology, disjunction, what that refers to, conjunction, material implication. Necessary and sufficient conditions we talked about, so you might want to review that. And that all has to do with the horseshoe symbol. You don't need to memorize a certain argument form. In other words, we talked about modus ponens and modus tollens and hypothetical syllogism and that kind of thing. I'm not so concerned at this stage that you recognize the modus ponens argument. But if I gave you a modus ponens argument, I would expect you to be able to prove to me that it's valid. You know, not knowing the name of it, but I gave you that argument, and then using this very same method, you could show me that was a valid or invalid argument. The names modus ponens and modus tollens and things you will start having to learn pretty soon, because we're going to use those as ways to break down other arguments. But for this quiz, it's mainly just the mechanics of symbolic logic that I'm interested in. Does anybody have any questions? What do you expect?
Mike, you wanted to actually have things like a material implication be able to give you a definition, or it just in so much as that when we're working with these things.
Yeah, I'm not so much interested in all the wording and, you know, exactly the wording. I'm more interested in the truth table. And if I were to ask you to show me the truth table for the P horseshoe Q symbol, you know, for the implication, then I would expect you to write that down for me. Things like necessary and sufficient conditions, I would like you to review that, because that involves the way you translate an argument in language into the logical form. So things that involve how to translate from a language into symbolic logic, I do want you to take a look at. And that's what one of the exercises we gave the last time, I think, the last exercise we gave involved. And I'll give you maybe a statement in English and you put it in symbolic logic. So if I say such and such a necessary condition for such and such, then I expect you to be able to put that symbolic logic in the right direction. I did. Okay. Anyone else? Question?
Mike, did you mention that one thing about that equivalent when you just mentioned that necessary condition?
Okay.
Because those are, you can reverse those.
Yes. You mean necessary and sufficient conditions. If you have both things involved, you have what we call an equivalent.
Okay.
I'm not sure if at all. Well, it's really stating P horseshoe Q dot Q horseshoe P. In other words, the two statements are implying each other. In fact, we're going to come to that right today.
Okay.
And we'll have another way to symbolize that. But it means that P is necessary and sufficient for Q, and Q is necessary and sufficient for P. Yeah, necessary and sufficient both. That's where you get the equivalent. But necessary and sufficient alone just indicate a horseshoe, and whether it's necessary or sufficient indicates which term is on which side of the horseshoe, basically. I think if you just review the discussion we had on that, it'll probably clarify that. I'm not going to lay a lot of emphasis on that, but just so you basically are familiar with that terminology is the most important thing, and you know. If I make a statement that such and such is necessary for such and such, if you know how to put that symbolic logic and get the right term on the right side of the horseshoe. Okay. Now, today we want to continue our discussion of statement forms, because this is going to be leading up to discussing things like tautologies and contradictions. We just arrived at the definition of those terms last time. We saw that a statement is a tautology under what conditions?
The concluding column is all one.
Yeah, in other words, its truth table has only ones in the truth column. That indicates a tautology, means it's always true, regardless of whether the elements are true or false. It's always true. And a contradiction is the statement. What does the truth column look like for a contradiction? All false, all zeros. Statement's always false. And then what word did we have to define one that was in between, had some ones and some zeros?
Contingent.
Contingent. Means that the truth of the final statement depends on the truth of the variables involved. So it's contingent upon the truth values of the variables involved. But a contradiction isn't contingent because it's false no matter what the initial variables are, what their truth values are, it's always false. And the tautology is always true no matter what the variables you start with are, whether they're true or not. Okay, now not all statements can be so obviously classed into one of these groups. It's not so obvious by looking at it. P and not P is pretty obvious. But if you saw a statement like this, to look at that statement, it's not abundantly obvious and immediately obvious that that's a tautology, but it turns out to be. That's always true. But you could prove that with a truth table again. But so we will use the word tautology, and sometimes things are obviously tautologies. Most of the time they're not obviously tautologies. It takes a little bit of work to crank it out and find out. Okay, now we'll define another logical function here, and that's this triple equal sign. This is another logical function like the horseshoe and the dot and so forth that we've looked at in the curl. This is called a material equivalent. Material equivalent. I'll just say it in words first and then we'll define it with the truth table. Two statements are materially equivalent when they are either both true or both false. Two statements are materially equivalent when they are either both true or both false. This function is defined by the following truth table. Put it on the board. This means P is materially equivalent to Q. Now we define the truth table as P is materially equivalent to Q if both P and Q are true or both P and Q are false, but not if one is true and one is false. In other words, what we're really saying is that they have the same truth value. This material equivalence is a true statement when they both have the same truth value. In other words, we're saying that both P and Q are either both true or they're either both false. In other words, they've got the same truth value. They're equivalent to each other in truth value. That's what this symbol means. Can anybody guess from those words alone what this might look like? Yeah?
Could be 1001.
1001. Yeah, because 1000 would be the P dot.
Yeah.
So this is 1001. In other words, it's true when they have the same truth value. Here they're both true, here they're both false. So that makes the statement true. But here they've got different truth values. So all we're saying is that they've got the same truth value. We don't care whether it's true or false, just the same. So that's the case when they're both true and when they're both false. So that's what your truth table looks like. That defines material equivalence. It means that they've got the same truth value. They're equivalent in truth value. If P is true, then Q is true. And if P is false, then Q is false. Okay. Now, if you're sufficiently attuned to this, you might guess that this is really the same as saying this. In fact, that's exactly what it is. If we figured up the truth table for this expression, we come up with the same thing. Because what we're saying is P implies Q and Q implies P. In other words, they're both going to be the same in truth value. It's the case that both P and Q, see, if P is true, then Q is true. And if Q is true, then P is true. all it said. If he's true, then you are true, and if he was true, then he is true. In other words, they're going to have the same truth value. They're going to imply each other. Another way to say it. State it. And maybe we should do this just so that you all believe it. Okay. Let's put P horseshoe Q here, and Q horseshoe P here, and then we'll have this ready to go. Okay. P horseshoe Q, 1, 0, 1, 1. Q horseshoe P, got 1, 1, 0, 1. Now we make a conjunction from these. So the conjunction is true if they're both true. It's false if they're not. These are both true. So we hold 1001, 1001. Exactly the same. So this is really saying the same as this. And actually, it's also the same as saying, maybe I shouldn't say this. But this expression is really the same as this from one of the rules, one of the exercises we have. And what we're really saying is P implies Q and not P implies not Q. And you add those two together and you come up with the same thing. In other words, this statement here would be saying if P is true, then Q is true, and if P is not true, then Q is not true. In other words, if P is true and Q is true, this is the true statement, and if P is not true, this is false, and then Q is going to be also false. In other words, they're going to have the same truth value. That's all we're really saying, that there's equivalence, is that these two expressions have the same truth value.
But they don't have the same material equivalence.
Okay,
you could.
Well, that's what...
And you couldn't relate those two in that word.
These two expressions here?
Right.
In other words... Yes, as it turns out, these things are materially equivalent. In fact, they're even more than that. They're logically equivalent, and that's the thing I want to define. They're identical in their true value. But for right now, let's just define material equivalence by this truth table. Material equivalence means that two statements have the same truth value. I mean, in other words, it's true. The material equivalence operator is true in the case when they both have the same truth value, and it's false in the case when one has one truth value and one has another. It's probably better not to say any more than that as far as defining that operator is concerned. And then we'll take it another step.
I didn't get what you were saying about the not to you, who's she not to you?
Oh. The thing that I remember, what number was it? Was number 3 or something on your exercises where we had P horseshoe Q, therefore not Q, horseshoe not P. We found that was valid. In other words, we can reverse the term. We can negate this thing if we reverse the terms. We can negate both members and reverse the terms and still have the same statement. And in other words, it'll be implied by this. And so, if I know Q horseshoe P is true, then not P horseshoe not Q is really the same statement as this. And so, if I substitute that up here, then P horseshoe Q and not P horseshoe not Q is equivalent to this statement. P is material equivalent to Q. If you think about it, that's what we're saying. If P is true, then Q is true. And if P is not true, then Q is not true. And in other words, reduced, P and Q are going to have the same truth value. If P is true, Q is true. If P is not true, Q is not true. And that's what this equivalent sign is saying, that they've got the same truth value. And so as we go through the various possibilities, we call this true whenever they have the same truth value. The first and last position is not true, though, in the case that one is true and the other is false. I didn't mean to confuse you by this. You'll understand it easier later on. But I just couldn't resist the temptation. Okay. All right. But all you need to know for right now is that this is an implication. It's adding the two implications together. P implies Q and Q implies P. That's really what we're stating as far as the equivalent sign.
Is that only in the last case? Like the first P horseshoe Q, it would be not Q horseshoe not P.
Yeah, if I wanted to reverse this, I'd have to go not Q horseshoe not P. You could do it that way too, and then say Q horseshoe P and not Q horseshoe not P. Just get it backwards, but it's still the same statement. If Q is not true, P is not true. If Q is true, P is true. You could put a different order with words. Okay. Now, this symbol might be read also if and only if. P if and only if Q. Another way to state this. So if you're, if you see the statement, if you see a statement in English, such and such, if and only if, such and such, it translates into logic this way. P is materially equivalent to Q. Because what it's saying is P is true if and only if Q is true. So if P is true, Q's got to be true, and if Q is true, then P's got to be true. They imply each other, which means that if one of them's false, the other one's got to be false, too. Because what you're really saying is that you've got to have the same truth value. P is and only if Q, which means that if Q's not true, then P's not going to be true. P if and only if Q. And so we end up with this truth table. That's a way to, another way of stating it. If and only if. See, the phrase if and only if is a biconditional, we call it. You get both sides of conditional. This is where some theological mistakes are made, because the scripture may only state one half of the conditional, and the person supplies the other half, and he makes it sound like if and only if when it only said if. And people do that a lot. They'll read an if and only if into something when it's not really there, and you can get into real trouble that way. And you can start inventing promises that God didn't make, and you can get in trouble. Well, we'll show you an example of that later. So, this notion of the triple equal sign can be translated if and only if P is materially equivalent to Q, or it can also be called a biconditional. This statement is called a biconditional. See, now, P horseshoe Q is a conditional. This is a biconditional, because you've got two conditionals put together in reverse order there. That's why they get the term biconditional, two conditionals there. Because it's the same as this, P horseshoe Q and Q horseshoe P, called biconditional. That's the last bell? Okay. Well, that's a pretty good place to stop. We'll start doing something with this next time. Well, if we have time after the quiz. I call it a quiz, not a test, so it won't be as intimidating. All right. But review your material. If you find during the week that you've got problems that you hadn't anticipated, don't hesitate to let me know. I'll be glad to sit down and talk with you about it and do all I can to make sure you understand it. Okay. The real problem there is the truth of the premises.
Right.
Starting
moral issues and fraud.
This is the kind of thing we're dealing with in logic theory. Showing the way that they'll change the sense of the word in the middle of the argument, or and commit ambiguity. Very difficult.
Is there a part of your life, I don't know how I do it, but
I wish anybody hadn't gone. I could have held off in collecting those so that they'd have them to review. I can do that, though. That's no real problem.
Can the office distribute them?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'll just correct them and I'll just stuff them in the box and I'll distribute them. I can have them in the box. Okay, sure. Thank you. Thanks for reminding me that would be helpful.